Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. We have members wandering in and out. They'll be wandering in. There are other meetings that are going on right now. We expect to have eight members of the committee overall. We only have one bill that we have the fiscal on to move out, so we'll be prepared to move that one out. But we will hear some other things. And because there is a contingency, a time contingency, I'm going to open up a hearing on HR 18 and invite one witness to start us off, and if you please. And then we will close that and move on to some other stuff so our witness can get on to important matters.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick and members of the House Health Care Committee. My name is Karen Elliott. I've been a nurse for over 37 years, and I'm an active member of Oregon Nurses Association. Presently, I volunteer in a clinic in Silverton for people who cannot afford to buy health insurance. I'm here today to speak out as a nurse and for those people, and for all people, young and old, who cannot afford to buy health insurance and do not have access to even the barest of health care. Many of the patients who visit the free clinic say they feel ashamed that they have to accept charity care. They often have put off coming to the clinic because of the shame. Many have recently lost insurance coverage because of the loss of a job, and they're no longer able to see their regular care provider. And they feel ashamed. I say no. I think we should all feel ashamed that we've allowed this to happen to as many citizens in as rich a country as most of us enjoy. Our country has fallen behind many other industrialized nations in caring for our citizens' health. We have poorer health outcomes and higher infant mortality rates, while medical care actually costs more.
Oh, could I ask you to, everybody, follow me now. Take out their cell phone and turn it not to silence but to off. That would be, oops, I missed. I turned it to silence. Now, okay. Please go ahead.
I might repeat that last sentence.
I think it would be a good idea.
In this country, we have poorer health outcomes and higher infant mortality rates, while our medical care costs are higher than those other nations I was speaking of. And to me, that feels a lot more shameful. In this country, in this state, all citizens have the right to an education. They have a right to vote when they become a certain age. Everyone has the right to free speech and the right to worship as they please. It seems obvious to me that all our citizens must also have the right to access health care. Yes, we all have a personal responsibility for our health status as well, to behave appropriately, to maintain good health. However, in our current situation, only those people with money or with health insurance have the right to seek comprehensive, preventative medical information and care. Only people with money or insurance have the right to seek appropriate treatment in case their health fails. We Americans are so proud to quote our national constitution, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If we believe these truths to be self-evident, where is the right to the same health status, whether you're rich or poor, handicapped or exceptional, a child or an elder, a McDonald's employee, or a space engineer? Can all citizens truly have a full life, have true liberty, and honestly pursue happiness if they are ill and untreated and feeling ashamed? It is way past time for equal health care for all under the law.
Thank you. Any questions? Can I ask you a question, please?
Yeah.
Ms. Elliott?
Oh, sorry.
Is it safe to say ONA supports House Joint Resolution 18?
Absolutely, yes. ONA supports.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your
testimony. Any other questions before I get up?
I will close the public hearing. We'll be back with another one in a few minutes on HJR 18 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2824. Laura, could I have the sign-up sheet, please? Okay. Courtney Dresser, do you want to start us off and bring whoever you want for the opening ceremonies here?
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. Thank you so much for hearing House Bill 2824 tonight. In a moment, you'll have some written testimony from the OMA, mostly written by our legal side of the team, so I'm not going to cover all of it. I want to highlight a few things.
Courtney, can we just hold on a moment? Mm-hmm. I forgot to invite our administrator to tell us about the bill.
What this measure does is it creates a cause of action for the medical provider to pursue a claim if the insurer does not pay the provider's claim within specified times. It deletes the current language of ORS 743-911 that requiring timely payment by the insurer does not create an assignment of payment to a provider. It imposes a civil penalty against an insurer of not less than $100 per day for the violation. Penalties to be paid into the state treasury and credited to the Rural Health Services Fund. Declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Courtney, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No problem. House Bill 2824 basically has two purposes. One is to put all health insurers in Oregon on an even playing field when it comes to the prompt pay law that we have in the state. And second is to provide an enforcement mechanism for our prompt pay law. Almost every state, I believe all 50 states, have prompt pay laws, and many are right now are going through this legislative process, as Oregon is, to look at evening the playing field on that issue, including all health insurance plans that are provided in that state. We did have a conversation with the OMA, a couple members of the health insurance lobby teams here in the Capitol, and they did point out a couple of issues for us. We have drafted some amendments, which are also being provided tonight, that we would hope the committee would consider some of the issues to help clarify plans that are administered by a third-party administration, and also clarifying the out-of-network issue. This legislation with the amendments won't affect some out-of-network issues, out-of-network claims, and we understand that just probably won't happen. However, those are pretty far and few in between. Today, I've also brought with us two administrators of practices in the Portland area and Washington County area who can kind of describe this, what this process is in an everyday practice. So they should probably be heard second.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, I'm Barbara Tauscher, Executive Director for Gastroenterology Specialists in Oregon City and Tualatin. I've also been in practice of administrator for a small family practice office in Reedsport, Oregon. And basically, when I practiced or worked there, we lived from paycheck to paycheck from our insurance carrier. So we often had to ask the bank to float our funds in order to make payroll because we were waiting for our Medicare check to come in because the budgets are that tight in some small, especially rural practices. What we're asking for is kind of fairness in the prompt pay law to allow for self-insured parties who go through third-party administrators to also be underneath this prompt pay law so that we're paid in a timely manner. When self-insured employers have claims out to a medical provider, they usually release funds to a third-party administrator, and they release them kind of on their own time schedule. So we may provide services the 1st of January and not be paid until April or May. And when all of us have bills that are due, as you know, the PG&E or the water company doesn't allow me to wait for payment or give payment to them as I'm waiting for payment. We're asking for that fairness and the prompt pay law to do that, to just make a level playing field as the third-party administrator should be paying us within the 30 days as well. And also then on the reinforcement side, we're looking for the prompt pay bill to be reinforced to allow some enforcement to that piece so that if they don't pay, there are some consequences to that. So again, I appreciate you looking at this piece for us.
Thank you. We'll have questions as soon as we're done with the panel.
Okay. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Mary Kay Brady, and I'm the administrator of Women's Clinic. Both offices of our offices are in Portland. We have been practicing in the Portland metropolitan area for in excess of 40 years, caring for women, providing health care to them in all stages of life and in all walks of life. Today I would like to discuss the effect that self-insured plans have on our patients, our physicians, and our clinic. Most employers who self-insure their employees are less than proficient in adjudicating the claims, and frequently they do adjudicate their or attempt to adjudicate their claims instead of going to the third-party payer. And when they learn that they just can't proficiently adjudicate claims, they do hire a third-party payer, at which time, if we've sent in claims, those claims get lost in the process. And they truly do get lost. Then when we try to submit them to the new TPA or third-party payer, they're too old. They're late in timely filing. And so then we go back to the company and they say, well, there's nobody here to adjudicate them any longer. We can't do it. So we've lost that. And we either then put the onus on the patient who has insurance, or we, you know, just write the cost off. And, you know, it's mandatory that all insurers doing business in Oregon are held to the same requirements, whether they are large or small insurers, whether it's self-insured or they're out-of-state insurers. Physicians provide care to patients in good faith and must receive compensation for the care that they provide. Historically, insurers have found inappropriate ways to hold payments to providers. This situation increases every year during the months of November and December. If insurers do not receive premiums for their insurance coverage of their clients, our patients, the patient is no longer covered, but we still provide the care. And this is a very important bill that I think is mandatory that it be passed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there questions of the panel? You have the amendments and the, or proposed amendments.
Proposed amendments.
And the bill, right? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, just looking at the amendments, the second line of your proposed amendments, where would you insert the "and not"? Drew my attention because it was probably switching something from, by putting a "not" in front of it, I thought. Be worth knowing where you propose to do that. This may get more technical than we want to be now, but if I'm...
No, that's I think, a substantive question.
There it goes. Thank you. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
My understanding would go after enrollee.
So it would restore the language on behalf of an enrollee and not pursuant to a contract between provider and the insurer.
Correct.
Okay, I'll have to see the actual engrossed or a hand engrossed version of this to sort of make sense of the effect of the changes on the proposed amendment.
Mr. Chair,
we would like that.
I think my understanding of what that the purpose of that is to make it clear that there is a payment obligation even where there's no direct contract between the two companies. That's why we're saying and not under the amendment.
Is there not a payment obligation if there's a contract, or then the contract is the overriding, creates the obligation, not the statute? Is that sort of the intent here, to deal only with cases where it's not a contract?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the intent is, but I interpret the purpose of that change to be that the payment obligation doesn't depend on a contractual relationship between the insurer and the provider.
No, it's independent of that, I think is what it says.
Right.
It says when a provider submits a claim on behalf of an insured, not on their own behalf, that's not a part of anything outside of this subsection. The other subsections go on to talk about when there is a contract between a provider and an insurer, I think.
Mr. Chair, the big part of their amendment, this too, except as provided, all of that deals with pursuant to a contract. So they're adding a bunch of language that duplicates, proposing to add language that duplicates this section 1 sub 1. Then they create a section 1 sub 2, which deals with when it is pursuant to a contract.
I think that's exactly.
I'm not sure why that's the approach taken, but I think I understand.
Have an answer?
My understanding that was the examples that were given were dealing with the out-of-network issues, and so we're trying to convey the kind of in-network and out-of-network, and it was easier to put them in their own two pieces.
Well, maybe when the insurance industry tells us what they don't like about it, we'll get a better idea of what the issue is. Thank you very much.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So, ladies, I'm shocked that the insurance companies would not pay promptly.
For you to suspend disbelief.
It's rhetorical.
Yeah, it seemed it was. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have an offer of testimony from John Powell, Dave Fiscom, and Fawn McNeely.
Industry.
On behalf of Regions, Providence, and ODS. I'd love to have you three competitors up here at the same time, if that works.
Yeah. I said by Fawn instead.
Actually, the light was shining off your head.
I'd be careful of bald jokes if I were you.
I just wanted you to know that Representative Greenlick and I are supporting the Rogaine mandate.
Okay. Well, the order I have on the sheet is Powell first, Fiscom, and then McNeely, but you can go in any order you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2824. Mr. Chair, we just now received the amendments as you have, so we're not going to be able to enlighten the committee too much in terms of how they deal with the construct of the bill. However, it does appear, first let me say that in 2001, insurers in the OMA and DCBS worked diligently to craft this current law, and it's working. We report annually to the insurance division on this matter on a form they prescribe. We've had market conduct exams in this area. And we do pay a penalty if we do not pay promptly, and it's 12% interest. So there is a penalty provision in the law. Most of our claims are paid promptly and within the time of receiving a clean claim. It was explained to us that the reach of this bill is to get to third-party administrators. I still don't see how it does it, because it refers to bills submitted to a health insurer. Third-party administrators are not health insurers. So I don't know how this bill reaches to those. We believe from the insurer's side that the existing law is working, and that, indeed, if there's the need for some further reach of this legislative intent, that it be done in a different section, and to leave the insurer part which does appear to be working. Another just quick read of the amendments. If you require a contract between a provider and an insurer to exist, then indeed there will be some insurers who do not contract with providers who would be exempt from the law. So we still have those types of questions about the body of the law.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
Could you tell us what, if you look at the amendment, mm-hmm. and look at the third line under 2, it talks about an insurer or any other entity licensed under the insurance code to administer health insurance benefit plans. Is that a third-party administrator?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe a third-party administrator is licensed. I'm
okay.
looking at Mr. Becker, who's third-party administrator is licensed, are by the insurance division.
Licensed under the insurance
in
code.
The okay. If they're in the state, then my understanding is they are
state
licensed.
Only TPA would. So this is how you get to a TPA, I think. Anyway, I'm sorry, John. Go ahead.
We do object to a private cause of action. Again, we do not believe, at least from the insurer side, that this change in the compromise we reached in 2001 has merit, and we would oppose the bill for that reason as well.
Thank you. Fiscom?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiscom here for Providence Health System, including Providence Health Plans, which is not as large an insurer as the gentleman's to my right, but still we're involved in the insurance industry. We don't see a reason to proceed with this piece of legislation, and in fact, for that reason, for similar comments to the ones John made, we would oppose it. This has the potential to impose substantial costs at a time when all of us ought to be doing what I know you're trying to do elsewhere, which is contain costs. I also don't believe there's a rationale for inserting in the way it's done here a third party in what should be contractual relationships between two willing parties. There are provisions in Oregon law that you can read on the first page of the bill that pertain to timely payments. John has well said that some years ago, 2001, three sessions or four sessions ago, we sat around for a long time in a consensus process drafting that piece of legislation. And I believe that, as John says, there's no reason to rescind that compromise reached then. We see no reason to do so. We don't believe at the moment that DCBS does, though DCBS can speak for itself. And we share John's concern relative to the private cause of action. There are adequate remedies in current statutes. ORS 743.913 already addresses this by requiring insurers to pay interest for late payments, which is, I think, an adequate provision, one worked out some years ago that still has merit today. So for all those reasons, we would join Regents and others in suggesting that there's no reason to make this change unless someone needs to provide a reason for us to rescind the existing prompt pay statute already on the books with which we comply. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn McNeely. I'm representing the ODS companies. ODS is opposed to this bill for many of the same reasons already outlined by Regents and Providence, and specifically the private cause of action section. I don't think there's anything else that I need to add.
How about questions, folks? Any?
I have a question.
Okay, let's start that way and come this way, and then we'll come down here.
Okay. Dave, you mentioned, thanks, Mr. Chair. Dave, you mentioned that there'd be costs as a result of that. So were you thinking of the potential cost due to right of action?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembrough, sure, that would be a cost. There's always a cost for new administrative bills passed by this legislative session, and in your judgment, some of those costs are worth incurring and some of those costs aren't. And I would rather have our focus be on cutting health care costs. I'm not alleging that this is going to have a direct impact on health care costs, but it could. Whenever DCBS incurs new responsibilities, as conceivably could occur under this, those costs are financed by the insurance industry, which finances DCBS, and that will have its administrative costs. But as to a calculation, we have not done that, nor would it be appropriate for us to do that. It's a more of a general issue that I hope, wish, aspire to our focus in this building being on healthcare reform, reforming healthcare as to its costs, reforming healthcare as to delivery, as well as to access, and I do not believe this bill does any of those.
Representative Bruin?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Coming this way.
Coming this way. The question standing three, although John and Dave, you mentioned it, that there is, in current statute, there is a remedy for late payment. My question would be, help me understand who and how that's done and how often it happens. I mean, is it a remedy that's invoked often or is it very infrequent?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, I could get you exactly the information on when Regents has paid interest. I don't have that information with me in terms of the rapidity
this way, that may.
of that. So Mr. Becker may be able to answer that.
But, and the question I'm trying to get at, of course, is, you know, it was with the previous, earlier testimony, it was implied that this is a common practice, the late payment, and so it would, to me, that would make me believe that maybe it's a common practice that it's adjudicated within the current statute or not. So I'm just trying to.
As my colleague, Mike Becker, gains his equilibrium coming to the witness table, I would just say that the best source of data on that would be DCBS, in fact, relative to the range of late payment issues that have existed. And without attesting to this point from my own knowledge, this is the first I've heard of it in terms of this legislative session. So DCBS would be the best source. Mike?
Do you have a comment?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Bruin, in regard to your question as to the...
ID, please.
yeah. For the record, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I knew who I was. I just didn't tell you.
I did, too. I thought we'd share it with that world out there.
The question was in regard to how often the penalty is applied under the current statute. And in the most recent reporting for the year 2008 for Regents, we paid 3,600,000 claims in 2008, of which 303,000 were paid late, to which we applied the 12% interest, and that interest is paid directly to the providers.
There's some teeth in the current statute.
Correct. Yeah. I would like to get that 12. Chair Greenlake, Representative Bruin, I would think a lot of people would like to get that 12% rate of return on that. But
can I ask one more follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, and that's both on the third administrative side, both sides of your corporation.
Chair Greenlake, that is on the insured side.
Okay. One follow-up. To the rate of interest, the 12% rate of interest, how is that determined? I mean, if a payment is a month late, is it 12% on the balance or is it 12% annualized? So it's, you know, effectively 1% per year. I mean, my question is there an incentive? If something's going to be late anyways, is there an incentive to pay it a year late rather than a month late?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Bruin, it is 12% simple interest.
Simple interest. So it sounds like there is a reverse incentive. Okay. No, the statute has been pulled. It's a simple interest per annum, though. So I'm guessing that's prorated based on the time, whatever the period of time the payment is deemed late.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Bruin,
okay.
That is correct.
Okay. Representative Cannon?
Pass.
Representative Kotek?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just a comment and a question. I do think there's a reform aspect here of why we want to look into this, and I think it's about how much time are individual practitioners spending trying to figure out when their claims are going to be paid and the amount of time they spend on paperwork. So I do think there's an important issue here that we want to talk about in terms of system reform. What I'm hearing from you, we just had a panel having a contradictory perspective on what's going on and how well claims are being paid. You might all be good actors. So my question is it important enough to level the playing field so all insurers are as good actors as you? And if you agree with that, would you be willing to open up to DCBS the type of maybe they need more specific claims data from all the insurers to know if this is actually happening? Because it doesn't sound like there's been a third-party review of all this in a while. 2001's a long time ago. I'm just wondering if you would be open to that, if you think this is an important issue to level the playing field so all insurers are acting in the best interest of the system.
We report annually.
Yeah. Chair Greenlake, Representative Kotek, currently all insurers are subject to the prompt pay statute, and all insurers do report annually all insurers are subject to an annual market conduct examination of that report on prompt pay. What is not covered under current statute is reaching the self-funded groups.
May I follow? And I apologize for not being clear. So I guess my question is, would you support pursuing, I know it sounds like the language is not written correctly, but going after the third-party administrators to get to those self-insured, because that's a good chunk of the business here in the state, and that's a problem for our providers.
Yeah, the bill does two things, though. It does that, and it has this private right of action in both. Is that,
yeah.
I think that's where they're trying to go.
I'm less
I think that's a good question.
Rate,
would you support? Would you support the bill if it only went after the other half of your business rather than?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek, I think as Mr. Powell previously mentioned, if we are going to create a new issue or a new prompt pay requirement for self-funded entities, I think we need to do that entirely separate of the current statute. There's a great deal of mischief done, I think, in trying to amend this statute the way it is. If you look at the language that is proposed to accomplish the result that is intended, this language does not do it. And I can go into the detail of why that is if you would like me to. But even more importantly is in regard to the additional penalties that are opened up by this legislative proposal. We discussed these issues at length in 2001 under this work group that went on for months chaired by DCBS. These two penalties were on the table, and they were agreed to be removed from that discussion, and we came up with this 12% interest on the claims and the enforcement through the department. So that's why we have what we have in the current statute.
Yeah, quickly on this, huh?
Well, and again, if we can correct the language to get to the TPA issue, would you be supportive?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, my reaction to that is I don't represent the self-insured industry, and I think if we're going to reopen this regime of prompt pay, we ought to do that in a collegial consensus-building fashion as opposed to haphazardly. If, as you say, this is part of reform, sure, let's do it. But I think we need to do it in a different way than proposing a bill.
You want to try?
Mr. Chair, could I just add one thing? It was mentioned about Medicare, a Medicare check to a provider. Medicare is administered separately with its own prompt pay regimen. It's not subject to
at the federal level.
Sure. Thank you.
If we happen not to move this bill, could we get some agreement that you would move with the third party administrator? I don't think this is about the self-funded plan so much as the behavior of the third-party administrators, similar to the insurers. Is that something you would work with? You know, you folks have a piece of that. There are others. Work with the OMA to try and come up with a legal solution. I mean, I think it is reasonable if insurers have a prompt pay requirement that seems to be working, that the same principles ought to apply to a third-party administrator. I mean, that, you know, not talk about the private right of action or other pieces of mischief that you see in this bill, but that ought to be a simple thing to do, and I think that's where Representative Kotek was trying to go with that.
Mr. Chair, I'd just simply answer in the Regents case, we definitely would sit down at the table and look for a demonstration of where this problem is occurring and try to attack that problem. Again, we submit annual reports on this matter, and as Mr. Becker said, he could quote you to the penny what we pay.
Yeah,
and
except he told me that wasn't the third-party administrator.
Exactly, and we would be glad to sit down and discuss that. I did talk to some third-party representatives who believe they are subject currently and do pay interest, but I don't have any data.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2824 and open up a public hearing on the one bill we're ready to move today, if we so desire, HB 2165A. And can I call General Caldwell and Ms. Evans to the
standards?
Is somebody flying wing with you? Is that what it is?
You're going to be here at night.
we represent.
Did that not say Pam Evans?
Paul Evans.
Of course I did. No wonder I was having trouble reading that. I know you.
Mr. Chair, whatever you want to call me.
You're not Pam.
If Pam works, General, we'll go with Pam. Yeah, it kind of looks like a Pam.
General, will you start it off?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. House Bill 2165 is fairly simple and straightforward. What it does is it allows members of the Oregon National Guard who have military credentials with respect to their primarily medics, physician's assistants, and even some doctors in our case, to perform their duties in the state of Oregon during a governor-declared emergency. The majority of this impact would be with our medics who attend, who would probably be equated to an EMT 1 or 2 at a minimum, and have military credentials and been trained, they're appropriately trained. However, they don't necessarily carry an Oregon license. We're working with the Department of Human Services to try to get some reciprocity back so they can examine the training that they have to actually perhaps even give them an awarded license per se, but it's generally not required. It certainly, they do meet national standards, and we're starting the process of enrolling all of them in a national certification that Oregon does accept, but there's still a lot of work to do. This would aid greatly, I think, during a particular epidemic and or a major emergency where we can put our people out to assist Oregon citizens. They currently have the ability to render care to our people who are under the control and the command of the governor in a training event or to a weekend training assembly or during annual training. So this would make this a lot simpler, a lot easier, and then we wouldn't have to restrict them from doing what they're trained to do during an emergency. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all might have.
Colonel Evans, do you want to? It is Colonel.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, very briefly, this provides us more tools during times of crisis. It's of particular importance given the upcoming mobilization of about 3,000 of our troops. Should we find ourselves in a situation where mass casualties, pandemic, something like that is going on, with that capacity lessened and with the ongoing budget challenges at the local and county level, this is something we'd like to have shored up as soon as possible. But I'll try to answer any questions you might have, sir.
Thank you.
Just a real quick question. Mm-hmm. I know it depends on who and how many are deployed overseas or not deployed, but how many folks are we talking about within the Guard that would qualify under this? I mean, how many medics and...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, I believe the number that we came up with was right around 200-250 total. We have a total Oregon National Guard consists of roughly 8,600 Oregonians, both Army and Air, 6,500 in the Army Guard, 2,100 in the Air Guard. We're deploying approximately 2,600 of those folks in the first part of May 2nd and 4th are the deployment ceremonies, and so it's about that deployment will take not quite half of the Army Guard.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
this would include inactive as well. And I guess my point is, we talk about these worst case scenarios, and the Valley, just given the population centers, generally have more folks that aren't military that qualify. Of course, we get outside where some of the armories are, but that don't have the medical staff. And I assume what we're talking here is also what's the word I'm looking for,
Mr. Chairman?
Just inactive, but still guard.
It would not.
If they're not
members of the Oregon National Guard. We have two statuses you can have in the Oregon Guard. One is active, and one is the National Guard Reserve, which is predominantly a paper play. You know, it's a roster. And those are usually folks who, when you join the Guard or any of the military services, you join for 8 years. Our enlistments are 8 years, but yet only six of those are required to be active. So all members move into that Army National or the National Guard Reserve for that last 2 years. Our option is to put them into what is known as the Individual Ready Reserve. It's a big Army. We choose not to do that because that's not been a very good place for people to be because they get sucked out of that and sent to Iraq. So we've not done that. Our theory is if they've served 6 years in the Oregon Guard honorably, we're not going to subject them to that additional call-up.
So what's Title 32 orders, which is the
Mr. Chairman, Title 32 orders is federal orders that are, what it means is you're paid by the federal government, but you're under the command and control of the governor. Title 10 orders are you're paid again by the federal government, same pay, same benefits, but you're under the control of the president.
But there are two forms of active duty.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, just because we hear this term confused a little bit, active guard doesn't mean Title 10 active duty all the time. What active guard means is that you're showing up at the weekends and you're current, so that you're, that 8,600 people are active guardsmen.
Right.
The inactive force really are just that. They're not regularly drilling. They may or may not still be able to fit in their uniform. They may or may not even want to associate with the military. And the inactive ready reserve, which you've seen called up a number of times in the past several years, those are folks that are actually taken from the street, put back in the uniform on the big Army side or big Air Force side, and sent. So our universe is 8,600 folks that we can call upon with that 200, 215 medics.
I might just add that we do have the legal authority to pull people out of the inactive National Guard and bring them back into the active National Guard, those folks that hit that two-year.
So there is, I mean, my question, Mr. Chair, is if there is a worst-case pandemic,
correct.
And we're not talking about sending people to Iraq, we're talking about bringing people in Oregon that previously had medical training that maybe right. Do something else now, but still have the training that we're talking about here. We're going to want all hands on deck.
Yes, sir. If they fit that two-year cycle week in that period, we could pull them back in by order of the Adjutant General under the governor's authority, and bring them back into the National Guard. We could do that.
Thank you.
Other questions, please. So my assumption is, I mean, this kind of an emergency, you literally could call some up.
Yes, sir. Typically what happens in an emergency is that the governor calls out the National Guard under what is termed in the law state active duty, which means that the governor has control, as he does in Title 32 status, but the difference is that the state pays the bill for that individual for everything that happens. Pay, like forest fires are a good example. Most, if not all, of the forest fires that we've fought since I've been in this business, which has been a day or two, has been under state active duty. Katrina, for example, though, was an example where our folks mobilized under state active duty, deployed to New Orleans and under the interstate compact, and then were converted into Title 32 status. So it can go both ways. The federal government is getting more largesse, if you will, with major emergencies and extending the opportunity for us to use Title 32 status to get the burden off of the states on these big emergencies. So that's been a good thing.
Chair Greenlick, one last thing I'd like to add, because I know this has been an issue in other committees as well. This is only under a declared disaster.
Right.
The governor has said this is a big enough issue, we need to do this. This does not get in the way of 24/7 normal operations, get in the way of currently what is the protocols of the EMS system, but rather when those things are bad enough that we have to reach into the cupboard, we have that overhead.
And also I would suggest that our position has always been one of supporting local authorities, not supplanting them. So in our role, we don't supplant local authority. We're there to assist them and aid them and go to what they determine the need may be, not to just simply replace them, which was observed this winter up in Gresham. As you may recall, we went in and assisted the local fire and police to aid citizens who they couldn't get to. So that's pretty much the typical role. That's not our job to supplant people.
Right. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So someone who was coming out of the Guard and was DCMT sort of certified, what would they need to do? This is a somewhat different case, but I think it's relevant on the issue that underlies this bill. What would they need to do to obtain health practice licensing in civilian practice? How many hoops would they have to jump through? Because I think the motivation behind this bill is, look, these folks are already well trained. What generally, do you have a sense of what they would need to do if they were leaving the Guard and come into practice in a the comparable profession.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, I have an idea, and this takes a bit to explain, but in the Task Force on Veteran Services, we recognize that really one of the issues is how do we get folks from the training they got in the military that's legitimate into the workforce. So this has been an ongoing issue outside the context of an emergency declaration. But in this question, if a person was getting off or wanted to depart for a professional full-time career as an EMT, it really has to do with whether or not their military training allowed them the opportunity to get associated with the registry, the National Registry, which the Army, as I understand it, the Army and the Air Force have different training levels that allow them to be registered as an equivalent of a basic or an intermediate. I understand there's a lot of confusion over what an intermediate does these days, but nonetheless, we are working with the folks in the Department of Human Services right now to make that obstacle course smaller. And the answer right now has to do with what courses they got while in the military, and unfortunately, that isn't one consistent thread. I'll give you an example. In the Air Force, if you go to IDMT training, individual duty medical technician training, you actually end up with an associate's degree, so it's easier to navigate the obstacles in the state of Oregon to get your paramedic licensure. In the Army, there's two different kinds of medics, and depending on which version you are, it's easier or harder to be part of the registry. Added to that, and this is where it gets really confusing to me, Special Forces, which from my own experience I will tell you are some of the best medics in the world. I mean, they're doing field surgery in the middle of chaos. They may not be able to even be accredited as a basic because of the particular programming that's currently in place. And their training is, I mean, quite interesting. So it isn't an obstacle that is there. We're trying to work through it. Right now, my answer would be based on what their training was and whether or not they were associated with the registry.
I certainly hope that we're trying to lower those barriers, but given the workforce needs.
Representative Matthews actually has a bill, sir, that's working through the process that will allow Department of Human Services a little more flexibility in some of the rulemaking to make it easier to get folks that are registered into the workforce.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2165 and open up a work session on House Bill 2165A. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move HB 2165A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Harker moves HB 2165 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay. Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Hanemer?
Excused.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Excused.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion passes. Would somebody like to carry it?
Okay.
You're the one. Vice Chair will carry it. Close the work session on House Bill 2165. There are two joint resolutions. It was my hope today that we could pass HGR 18 to the Rules Committee, where they're gathering up proposed ballot things, and that we would pass HJM 20 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It turns out we're still waiting. The poor fiscal office is going crazy trying to provide the fiscals on this, so we'll hold it over. We'll hear both of them and end up holding them over until tomorrow, if we can get fiscals tomorrow. If not, we'll hold it over until tomorrow. If I'm reminded, we'll hold it over until Friday to make sure they're carried. So why don't I open the public hearing on HJR 20 and call Representative Dembro. Representative Barton wished to be here. but he ended up having to leave, so he will not be here. Following this, we'll do HJR 18. We have two witnesses. Emily Katz, who we haven't seen for a while, will you, all the way from Washington, D.C., join us also at the witness stand? Last session, you were a fixture.
Well, it's nice to be back. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Dembrough, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Michael Dembrough, State Representative, House District 45. And I bring before you House Joint Memorial 20, which I promised you a couple of weeks ago would be coming when I presented the bill regarding Medicare physicians who are not providing Medicare service.
Abandoning their patients is the way I.
That's another way to say it. Yes. So I promised at the time that we were developing sort of bigger picture look at the problem that. You know, at the source of the problem, at the heart of the problem was the low reimbursement rates that were being given to for Medicare, and particularly in Oregon. And so what you have before you is a memorial that would urge Congress to do to take steps to solve both those problems. First, to increase the reimbursement rates, the Medicare reimbursement rates for physicians, and to lessen the variation among reimbursement rates paid to the states, so that Oregon, which currently is able to provide service at lower rate, would no longer be penalized for that. So this is a memorial that I think is very timely and very consistent with our central message of healthcare reform, which is to improve primary care service and preventive service. This is really at the heart of that, and I urge you to approve it, send it to the floor, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is it your interest in moving both these bills simultaneously to the floor?
I think it makes sense to have both of them. If they're both going to move, then they should move together. But I think, since we have this before us tonight, it's hard to see that there would be a fiscal to this, since this is just a memorial to Congress. It seems to me we could probably just move this tonight.
Actually, we can't. By House
it's crazy.
I know, it's ridiculous. Yes, Ms. Katz.
Hi, for the record, my name is Emily Katz. I'm the public policy manager for CARE Oregon, and I handle their federal affairs now. So I'm based out of Washington, D.C. I'm their one employee on the East Coast, and it's nice to be back testifying in front of you all. And I feel like this is a really sort of easy job here because you guys are spot on with the recommendation, and I really want to commend the committee. What we're seeing with Medicare at the federal level now, we're really lucky that we have a federal delegation in Oregon who understands this issue, but not all of Congress is there. So certainly the timing is really good for our members, or the members in Congress, to see that this is coming from the Oregon State Legislature and that they have the support of Oregon. And I really have to commend you for tackling the geographic disparities issue, because that's something that is so critical to access in Oregon, our low fee-for-service rates, and like you mentioned, providers not accepting Medicare members. And so by identifying the fact that not only do our physicians need the adequate amount of money to provide services to our Medicare members, but also recognizing that geographic disparities do exist, I think there are members of Congress who are loath to bring this up, because it does set up state against state, but we would be remiss as a state who has historically low fee-for-service reimbursement, we would be remiss to not bring that up. And so I really just want to commend you for being really spot on with this, and I would really urge you to do more, as much as you can, a memorial, a letter, but to really be reminding anyone who will listen how Oregon would be disproportionately affected you know, if they were just to increase, say, provider rates but not address geographic disparities at the same time, because then we're going to see all physicians across the country getting more money, yet we maybe will have a little bump, but then still, I mean, I took a little piece from the Dartmouth Institute, which I'm not sure if this committee is familiar with, but they look at these issues of geographic disparity, and I'll just give you a really quick example. They say that Miami, where Medicare spent $16,351 per enrollee in 2006, cost rose at an annual rate of 5%. This increase was twice that of Salem, Oregon, where Medicare spent $5,877 per enrollee in 2006, and our growth rate was just 2.3%. And so, really, I mean, if you take that, we would really
Los Angeles, Brooklyn, Boston.
We can make Medicare solvent if everyone was paid at Oregon's fee-for-service rate. There would be no problem with
Medicare. Maybe that's
what
the memorial should be, that everybody gets paid like in Oregon.
Well, I'm going to keep my mouth shut on that. But we support the memorial as it's written, and so we would definitely urge this committee to move that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Questions of the duty pass?
I did not, actually. I didn't read from this, but I did.
Representative Harker?
Not a question, but a comment. I think this is a fantastic thing to do. I'm embarrassed that my name isn't up on the top there with you all, but I have physician friends who have, for years before I got involved in this, railed about how this is one of the largest issues facing this state. So, yeah, let's go for it.
Okay, thank you very much. When we move into work session, we'll ask Representative Barton to provide him a chance to say a few words as well. So, to close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 20 and open a public hearing on House Joint Memorial Joint Resolution 18. And I'll call Representative Greenlick to the witness stand. And I don't know, wish you guys are nicer to me when I'm there. Yeah.
Last time you gave it to me, we barely got out of the building.
You picked on me mercilessly. I think I remember protocol correctly. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and thank you for inviting me to speak before you today on House Joint Resolution 18, which is as personally important to me as any bill I've ever carried. It's a bill that has been a part of my professional life over the last 30 or 40 years. Trying to put forth the notion that health care is in fact a right of all citizens. I remember the sort of odd epiphany I had when I was about 23. Let's see, that would be 50 years ago. When I was teaching a pharmacy class, and I was teaching a class in sort of health policy related to pharmacy economics, and I was talking about a bill that was pre-Medicare and Medicaid in the U.S. House of Representatives called the Ferran Bill, a bill of Congressman Amy Ferran from the state of Rhode Island, and it was this modest bill about giving federal aid to the states to do something about the poor and the elderly, since we had not yet achieved Medicare and Medicaid. In fact, Medicare and Medicaid were unheard of. There were two or three bills came before it, and I was I actually told this story at the 50th anniversary speech I gave for my pharmacy graduation a bit ago. I was lecturing on about the dangers of socialized medicine, doing the sort of routine professional association models of the 1959 era, and talking about how providing federal aid to the states to help take care of poor people and elderly was a terrible thing to happen. It was the beginning of creeping socialism. It would be the camel's nose in the tent, and Western civilization as we knew it would come to an end if we had done something like this. And as I'm in the middle of talking, it came to me, what I'm saying is crazy. And it just sort of came to me in the middle of, I finally heard what I was saying. I said, this is absurd. This doesn't make any sense at all, what I'm saying. It's pure crazy. And if any of you have ever taught a class, and I know several of you have, can you imagine sort of 20 minutes into a 50-minute class coming to the conclusion that what you were about to say didn't make any sense at all? And it was a very memorable experience for me, and I sort of fumbled around a little and bluffed a little and changed the subject and did the best I could, which probably wasn't much better than I was at that age anyhow teaching this class. And then went home to think about it and spent a lot of time over the next few months thinking about it and came to the conclusion, even from the perspective of a very conservative pharmacy school background, that medical care wasn't a privilege. Medical care was, in fact, a right. And I'm not sure I exactly formulated it that way, but I know as my career developed, I kept thinking about it. Well, why would it be a right? Well, we were guaranteed the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, what does life mean nowadays? Well, life, it seems to me, means you have a right to life. The only way you can exercise that right to life is by providing health care, because what we know is that people that don't have health insurance, for example, die much more frequently of the same diseases than people do have health insurance. And that the overall mortality, everything else being equal, is people without health insurance die more than people with health insurance. Everything else taken into account. So effectively, in the modern Western society we have, the right to life, in fact, is the right to access to affordable and effective health care. And I'll be happy to talk about rights, and I have an 11-minute and 30-second speech here about where rights come from, and I'll actually be glad to review a little of that in a colloquium. It's nice having it tonight when we have this and House Bill 2009 on the agenda, because when we raised this in the last session, the question is, well, how would you move towards implementing the right to health care? But it boils down to this, and what I do want to read for sure is what it is we're asking the citizens of Oregon to vote on if we send this bill to the people for a vote in the next general election, which would be the November in 2012 general election. It's a very simple statement, and let me read that. We're asking them to say if they agree or disagree with this statement, and should, if they agree, it be put into the Constitution. All Oregonians deserve an equal opportunity to lead healthy and productive lives, which requires equal access to effective, medically appropriate, and affordable health care, a clean environment, and individuals assuming responsibility for their own health through the lifestyle and behavioral choices they make. Phase two, it is therefore the obligation of the state to ensure that every legal resident of Oregon has equal access to effective, medically appropriate, and affordable health care as a fundamental right. And that's a pretty straightforward statement. The preamble to that statement comes after long discussions with Governor John Kitzhaber, who objected to the earlier form of it, or was slow to endorse the earlier form of it, because he felt the whole notion of this A being medically appropriate, B being issues in the environment, and C being issues in individual behavior all move into this question of what is the right to health, how does the right to health operate through. It operates through all of these factors, through the environment, through our own personal choices, and through access to health care. I'll be happy to trace the history. What I can tell you is when we put a very similar proposition to this to folks in a poll, and we've done it now about three times, you generally get between 65% and 80% approval of that statement. There are factors that get involved in that discussion. You see in here the right limited to every legal resident of Oregon, because that always becomes an issue. The question is this: unlimited health care, everything. If I have a right to health care, can I demand everything of the state? No, the fact you can't. We're talking about medically appropriate, effective, and affordable health care is all that this requires. And furthermore, what's new now is after having the last year or so spent with the Oregon Health Fund Board, we are moving towards a plan that can actually make this operational over the next decade or so. And I think we are talking about something over the next decade. So rather than talking about how rights come from wrongs and reciting to you the President Roosevelt's fourth inaugural address, I'll stop now and open it up to questions, or I will give, if you want, my 11-minute and 30-second speech.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a member of the Health Care Committee, I love this resolution. But I can't resist asking a lawyer's question.
That's that's why we're happy to have you on the healthcare.
What committee. Happens if we pass this? What comes next? We did something fairly similar to this for education. It's in our Constitution. It led to years of litigation, at the conclusion of which the Supreme Court said, in effect, big deal.
Actually, we didn't do something similar to this in the education side. What we did in the education, what we said was basically we should fund education to a full level, and if we don't, we should write a note to mother explaining why we didn't. This, I think, is a relatively stronger statement than that, and I think we'll test the constitutional issue. And of course, there are lots of things in the Constitution, like the right to sell liquor by the glass, and the questions of how you restructure buildings to be seismically safe, and a lot of other important issues. But the issue that requires the legislature to decide what it needs to do and then has the obligation to raise the funds to do it is one that I think we might be closer to a constitutional requirement that's been in there for some time, in fact, maybe from the beginning. I think this is more equivalent to the statement in the Constitution that requires us to create a system of common schools in the state of Oregon. Now, that's been in the Constitution since it's not under the First Amendment. I mean, it's not under the Section 1, the right section. I think it's Section 3. But it is there, and it requires us to have a common system of schools. We were the first state to have that in our Constitution. It probably took us 70 years to get close to that, and we eventually did get close to it. But the consequences of it were very specific. Once the state had responsibility for dealing with education, it needed to do it in a way that that equalized the schools across the state, and it's done it. Did it do it instantly? No. Did it do it exactly right? No. But it was a guideline for the state to take seriously, and we've taken seriously. We've moved lots of money out of, say, the Valley, out to other districts, and we've done a lot to work towards it. I think that's all this requires us. Now, if we absolutely refused to move in this direction and we were blatantly out of whack, I think, in fact, it might be possible for there to be a court case that would require the state to do something. But I think that would be a long way off and I know lawyers need to deal with these kind of hypothetical questions, and they're not trivial. And this is, I don't mean to imply it's a trivial question, but I think it really requires us making good faith effort to move in that direction.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. sort of similar to Representative Garrett, I love the fact that I love the fact that you've brought it again, because I have enjoyed now for a couple years at least the discussion on this, and you probably were going to say this. I'm going to steal your thunder from something he said a year ago. I don't know if you were in the press or it was just an offhanded comment, but in the discussion we had, I think, on the House floor on this issue 2 years ago, Mr. Chair, I remember Representative Cannon saying this is the reason he joined. This sort of discussion was the reason he joined the legislature, or at least was his estimation of what the best part of being in the legislature was, and I agree with that.
My question, without getting into any of the discussion, because we've had this conversation, we'll have it more about the meaning of rights and what is a right and what's a responsibility and what's an obligation. You pointed out at the beginning of your testimony that what you're intending with this is a fairly simple ask. It's asking the people of Oregon, and here's basically all Oregonians deserve an equal opportunity to lead healthy and productive lives. It requires equal access to effective health care. My question is, if logically, if we want to ask that question to Oregonians, or we want to pose that question to Oregonians, does it also make sense logically to ask Oregonians the next step? You, at the beginning of your testimony, again said, you know, when we had a discussion 2 years ago, there was a question of what does that mean? Well, now we're at House Bill 2009. We have a better understanding, a better estimation of what that means. Is it logical? Can you argue for that if we're going to ask Oregonians the question if this is right, we should also ask Oregonians to make the determination on whether that or not they want the program, here's the detail of the program, and they want to pay for it?
Well, I would be delighted to have a requirement that our constitutional amendments do that. And for example, we had Measure 5, which nobody was really faced with the consequences of what happened when we take money out of the local schools and the obligation of the state and don't give the state any more money as to what impact that would have on schools. I'm sure that if we could take them 10 years downstream and give them a vision, it's sort of like in the movies, you know, here's what it's going to look like 10 years from now. If you do that, we would not have had Measure 5. I think Measure 11 in some ways would be the same way. If we look downstream 10 years to the fact that this would create a state that had more incarcerated citizens than any state in the country, and that it would cause a tripling in the prison budget, we might not. We take things on faith, and we try and as a state do the best we can. I think we are further ahead because Senate Bill 329 caused us to go around all over the state asking questions about these kind of questions: are health care a right? How do these rights operationalize? And we are trying now to create step one of moving in that plan. I think by the end of the 2011 session, I'm hoping we will have a bright, clear plan to the future, but I don't think we have that plan yet. Is it going to be complicated? Yes. I mean, can we tell citizens what it really means? I don't think 2009 is the way to implement. I think it's step one to begin moving us in that direction.
So just let me, Mr. Vice Chair, if I can, here's the right, here's the road, and you're saying at this point you're not ready to you don't want to be on the same page with House Bill 2009 to sort of, you say it's too early. I mean, I don't want to put words in
I don't think 2009 produces the bright, clear vision of what life will be 10 years downstream if we had done that. I think it's one piece of what we ought to do. It's one way to respond to this, but I don't think it's the way. And I certainly think 2009, which would be the first step, doesn't have anything like the economic consequences we're talking about. It's very interesting. When I was working on this as an initiative several years ago, there is a committee that's required to produce an economic impact statement. A fiscal impact statement. And basically their statement was there isn't any way to know what this will ultimately cost. I don't think 2009 is an example, especially when we separate the taxes of that. Yeah, if all we had to do was sell, if this was sort of a prize that came in that Cracker Jack box of 2009, you also got, if you vote for 2009, you also get equal rights. I would certainly be willing to sell that Cracker Jack box. I mean, I remember seeing a carny harker who could sell, was selling these boxes with prizes in it until he ran out of boxes, and then he started tearing them up and selling the pieces on the sense that there was a prize related to this piece somehow. I mean, we could sell that, but the truth is, this is a much more serious question than that. And yeah, if we said to people, you believe healthcare is a right, and are you willing to pay $10,000 a year in taxes to pay for it? The answer would be, I'd probably be the only one. No, I think you would too, Representative Maurer. The only one who might sign up for that. But, I mean, I don't think we can literally do that.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Just very quickly, is Section 1, is the preamble to this new? Was this
yes. A, well, it's not new since we wrote this, but it's
no,
new
but it's
from
new
the
since
version.
2008.
Yeah, the preamble, as I said, came from some long discussions with Governor Kitzhaber, and he argued for putting a preamble on it that puts it in context.
Philip, I really like it. I wonder if you or he considered, in the interest of symmetry, including in Section 2 a right to a clean environment, which Section 1 states is a condition for equal opportunity to lead a healthy and productive life.
I want to get something for the moment. President Roosevelt, when he declared this as a right, I do want to get to that in a moment, put a whole set of rights in it, including, he said, in order to have a prosperous America coming out of World War II, there needed to be, in order to have a healthy society, we needed to have a right to a job. We needed to have decent housing. We needed to have the ability to support a family. I mean, there were a whole set of these rights. And I think I would be willing to argue for the right to a healthy environment. I guess I'd also be willing to argue for a right to an individual's not to take responsibility for their own behavior, to be completely consistent in that. But I just picked out the one, and I would be happy to support that preamble and another resolution to get people to see whether they had a right to live in a healthy environment. I think I would be willing to argue for that. I mean, I think Roosevelt argued for a right to homes, and the government took action after World War II with for the veterans' loans for homes and with the Federal Home Administration and the variety of things. There was a right to food, and we've taken action to try and make sure there's food around. We haven't done so well with that as we have with homes, and we've done pretty well with homes until recently. But yeah, if you could, you want to use a priority bill to introduce a right for us to live in a healthy environment, I think we should start thinking about that because I think that's important.
Thanks.
Anybody else?
Call the next one.
Call the next one.
Thank you very
much.
There's no opposition.
Somebody's self for Blackberry's on.
On the gavel.
Dr. Huntington and Rand Dawson, sir.
Laura.
Let those two go together.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, I'm Mike Huntington, co-convener of Physicians for a National Health Program. I live in Corvallis. I wish to speak in favor of Joint House Resolution 18, possibly with a deletion of one word. In the United States, we guarantee everyone substantial protection from the hazards of fire, crime, food contamination, and other threats. How did public fire protection get started? Partly because our natural human characteristic of compassion, but also in the old days and even now, houses were built side to side. And if one person's house burned down, the next person's house might also. So the reason for public fire departments was compassion, but also with an element of selfishness, the best kind of selfishness. I think that as a corollary of mutual mutual preservation, we might apply this to guaranteeing health care for all. To allow each other the freedom and pursuit of happiness, as has been mentioned, we are guaranteed the protection from injury from other individuals, as shown by the police officer there, and also government. And we are guaranteed that the food we eat will be safe. Of course, these guarantees are not foolproof, and it's a constant battle to preserve them. But until now, a guarantee for health care has been left out. These people that you see there waiting outside the clinic are representing about a third of our population. And they have been told, essentially, I'm sorry, you have no insurance and you can't pay up front, but we can't take care of you now. Please come back when you are extremely ill. If then even the most frugal of us will guarantee you care. and will spend money, thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars in the effort. I'm sure you will see the wisdom of our policy. Oh, hello, Mr. Hardcastle. Yes, we'll take you right in. In my 35 years as a radiation oncologist...
And Dr. Huntington,
yes.
Did you know that there's a privatized fire department in the state of Oregon?
Well, how well is it doing?
Actually, it does quite well.
Is it serving all of us?
If you sign a contract, it will serve you, but if it gets a fire alarm, they roll, and they have a contract with them. And if you're there to sign the contract and you agree to a contract, they fight your fire. And if you don't, they hang around and protect houses that have signed up.
Actually, that's not true.
I heard it was. I absolutely heard it was. Which county is it?
It's in Justin County. Not
alone. Thank you, Representative Maurer, for pointing that out.
Sorry.
I was not aware.
Yeah.
Until now, we do not have a guarantee for health care. So I wanted to point out that in my 35 years as a radiation oncologist, I've observed that Americans have yet to define a balance between market justice and social justice. In the last 10 years of my career, I was distressed to witness and be part of a high-tech infatuation that actually tripled the cost of some of our treatments. And as a result of costs being passed on to insurers, the premiums doubled during that time. Families like you see on this photograph then dropped off the bottom rung of the ladder of insurability. These are the people I would see several years later with advanced neglected cancers that we would then employ our high-tech, high-cost treatments for. A small investment years earlier would have prevented this suffering and cost. I acknowledge that there is a necessary tension between social justice and market justice. Social justice includes distributive justice, which means we all have an equal chance at achieving good health. That doesn't mean we all get MRIs on demand. Most of our religions and our American tradition compel us to take care of the sick and the poor, wish others well, and have compassion for each other. Now, these are the things that I've mentioned, but I acknowledge that we do need market justice also. Without it, we probably would not have a productive society, free enterprise, or proper incentive to take care of ourselves. We need a balance between the two. Most other industrialized countries in the world have found that balance and give their people good health at half the cost that we spend. Without access to health care and protection from medically induced financial ruin, our small businesses and entrepreneurs cannot even get started. Where is the freedom of choice if you're tied to a bad job or even a bad marriage by health insurance? What happens to individual responsibility in a system where if you get sick, you might lose your job? If you lose your job, you lose your insurance. I know Representative Morrow is worried about that particular part of the tie of insurance to employment. How can we manage limited health care resources without a plan that includes everyone and uses thoughtful, evidence-based, and morally sound criteria for setting limits rather than using wealth as the criteria? I think we are long overdue in asking the state to ensure every resident access to medically appropriate and affordable health care. I would like to consider having you strike one word from the bottom of this, and that is the word equal access. Are we going to be able to guarantee someone in Burns or Lakeview the same access to MRI and specialty care as someone in Portland? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Committee, Rand Dawson, it's my pleasure to speak here as a recent honorable amateur after such a thoughtful discussion regarding the long-term issues associated. I appreciate this opportunity. I'm from the Silcoos Lake area in Lane County. We have a volunteer fire department there. My background is legal. I was a member of the Bar Association here in Oregon and Alaska, but I'm a long time retired. But my perspective on this particular issue in support of HJR 18 is that of a grandfather and an individual who wonders whether or not small businesses and families can continue to function with the healthcare situation, the financing situation that we currently have. So I would speak in support of the resolution. Our competitive, fragmented insurance-driven system has failed to provide meaningful affordability, access, or quality of care. We've spent about 2 years in the Florence area working on these particular issues. At one point in time, for example, in 11 days, we gathered 1,100 signatures in the library. It was one resident out of seven in that particular area to gather support for the legislative issues that preceded the last legislative session on this issue. And then this last four months, we've dealt with two resolutions that are similar to HJR 18, and we've succeeded in obtaining unanimous passage at a small town, Dune City, for example, and just this last week at Lane County, with regard to similar phrasing, similar issues. The thrust of the issues actually dealt with a fair national debate in terms of the current national health care debate with regard to single payer. And to be honest, we finessed the issue, and we didn't talk about fundamental rights. We talked about fundamental values. Justice Clarence Thomas appreciates values, and he's a little down on rights. So we did move a little off the issue, but my point is there's significant political will, I think, at the grassroots for this type of resolution. The Dune City decision was unanimous. They had a banker. They had a physician. The Lane County decision was unanimous. The facts that deal with, I think, the rationale why those governmental bodies and why we obtained, let's say, 1,100 signatures in a reasonably short time, the facts deal with the impending financial collapse that starts with 17% of our GDP currently is expended for health care costs shortly in 2018 to go to approximately 20%, which at that time it will represent $1 in five of ever dollar spent in the economy. It currently is the highest expense for a family above food and above housing. Some of the potential benefits, I think, of this particular resolution can be imagined by describing some particular examples of the problems that we've been able to see over the course of preparing for what level of activism or public education we've been involved in. There is, as you may know, a Regents Blue Cross rate increase pending for its approximately 79,000 policy holders. Regents Blue Cross is the largest carrier in the state, and the cumulative three-year rate increase will represent approximately a 57% rate increase. We currently, if we want to look at some of the characteristics of the existing system or non-system as we have it here, there's excessive and prevalent rationing. You can witness that by a review of insurance policy terms or a review of the consequences of the application of various underwriting standards. We end up with essentially a new class called the underinsured, and that's beyond the 40 million or the 45 million of the uninsured, so we have 45 million approximately underinsured. I have here an interesting graph from America's Health Insurance Plan, AHIP. This is an industry source, and it describes the type of coinsurance available to the individual market. And this is a type of policy, a PPO, preferred provider policy. Now, this is probably, let's say, 6 to 7% maybe of the Oregon market would be the individual and the family and individual market, I believe. And if we look at the coinsurance rates that are above, or the number of policies that are within the coinsurance group of, let's say, 20 to 40%, so the individual family's is self-insuring for between 20 to 40% of ever expense, it's 80% of the total policies issued. So that's a nationwide situation in terms of how large the self-insurance aspect is at the family level. I I found that striking. My practice dealt in the insurance field, and I didn't have any opportunity to go into facts like this, and I've found this over the last several months just to be a real eye-opener. What does that result in? It results in bankruptcy, where we're looking at about 45% to 55% of the people that take bankruptcy for medically related reasons have insurance. We're looking in terms of people my age, 3 out of 10 applications between the age of 60 and 65 are denied. It's another form of underwriting rationing. In terms of implications for the business sector, the impact on the business sector, 50% of businesses with less than 10 employees offer no forms of coverage. The good news is, I think, if you look at the Congressional Budget Office materials in terms of this cost trajectory, that's absolutely unsustainable. They have a graph that's interesting. It's the consumption, the GDP consumption for healthcare, and it's the GDP in about 2025 they come together. So it's 100% consumption of the national GDP.
Can I ask you to begin to wrap it up?
Yeah, and I thank you. And the result is we do have system savings, and the system savings opportunity, because these cost factors are not demographically driven, they're higher cost driven. This type of resolution will allow the state to play a part structurally or regulatory-wise to begin to bring those cost factors down, so we won't push people through the cracks any longer like the present system does. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Thank you very much. Can I call Joe Bessler, please, and Mel Rader? And then we'll finish with Emily Katz and Kat Livingston. I just to give you all a sort of sense of where we're going, we'll finish this testimony, close this hearing, and we'll do a modest amount of work on 2009. What I want to do is give you some updates on where 2009 and 2116 is going, and then I'm going to ask Tom Burns to review the amendments we think we have and the ones we think we have coming, so we know what we're up to. I really hope to pass 2009. Well, I hope to pass it tomorrow, but I'm not sure I will. So I would say I will hope to move it on Friday. Mr. Bessler?
Hello, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. My name is Joe Bessler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. In 2006, Chair Greenlink came and talked to our organization, a bunch of our members, and we endorsed the HOPE initiative then and the concept of health care as a fundamental right. And there's been, even though the measure is different, we still firmly believe, and in fact, as the years have gone by, it's become even more important. It's the biggest conversation we have at the bargaining table. It's the most talked about thing we have when a group of members, probably more than two, get in a room, they start talking about health care. I just want to say, for the record, Oregon AFSCME is in support of HJR 18, but that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. We appreciate it. Any questions? I suspect we'll hear if we seriously move into this. I mean, when we seriously move into this, either in the Rules Committee or when we start trying to raise money to support it, if it goes to the ballot, we'll be hearing from other of your colleagues in the labor movement.
I can add nothing to that.
Have been quite supportive in the past.
Yep.
Mr. Rader, you look familiar.
Yes.
Have you ever had anything to do with this amendment before?
Oh, yes. Quite a bit. Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. My name is Mel Rader from Portland, Oregon, and I'm project director for Upstream Public Health. And I could talk about this amendment from professional knowledge, but I'm choosing now to tell a personal story. And this happened just over 10 years ago, and I was one of the many Oregonians who didn't have health care for a number of years. And while I was studying in abroad in college, I developed a tropical disease that was undiagnosed, and I became very sick, losing nearly 60 pounds of weight at the time, couldn't sleep well for a number of years. And I received medical attention from a primary care physician in an emergency room while I was in school. But then when I graduated from college, I was no longer eligible for my school's health insurance, and couldn't afford to get any coverage on the small wages I was earning when I moved to a new city and picking up odd jobs. And so I quickly found myself in kind of a socioeconomic dead end. I didn't have a well-paying job, so I couldn't get health insurance. I was sick, so it was difficult to find and hold down jobs. And so it was a vicious cycle. Only through perseverance and years of struggle and pain was I able to get into a situation where I had access to health care. And it had real consequences for my own health. So, you know, I'm urging you today that, you know, in a country as rich as ours, where everyone should have access to effective and affordable health care, this is not just a moral imperative, but it's also a sound investment for Oregon's future. And my personal story demonstrates that a gap in health insurance can disrupt and destroy an individual's livelihood for years and decades to come. And but I was lucky because I wasn't one of the at least 350 Oregonians, adult Oregonians, that die each year because they don't have access to health care. And right now we're really facing a crisis where our emergency rooms are overflowing, and a lot of that is because emergency rooms are the option of last resort for those without health insurance. And this is neither good for the people that have to rely on emergency rooms, and it's not good for Oregon state coffers. So HDR 18, I think, is a real investment in the full range of preventive and acute healthcare services, promoting the health of Oregonians and saving millions of dollars in the long term. So I urge you to support and pass this resolution, and I'm fully confident the people of Oregon very much would support this resolution if they had the opportunity to vote on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ader.
Thank you very much.
Next, go ahead. Ms. Katz, Dr. Livingston.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, again, my name is Emily Katz. I'm the Federal Policy Manager for CARE Oregon, and I'm going to make my comments really brief because I know you do have a lot of work ahead of you still tonight. I'm pleased to say we're here in support of HJR 18, and we've been in support of it now for several years, and I think this is probably my third or fourth time testifying in support of the resolution. And CARE Oregon also was a supporter of the HOPE Amendment. And so really, I just wanted, again, to comment and sort of tie this to the federal connection, you know, because this is a top legislative priority for CARE Oregon. Access for All is something, again, that, you know, comes up around our table all the time, too, and you will see that at the top of our legislative agenda. And at the federal level, there's definite understanding that healthcare and the economy are inextricably linked. That's why you're seeing major healthcare reform proceeding at the federal level. And I really see HJR 18 complementing that work and complementing the work of our federal delegation, like Senator Wyden, with his Healthy Americans Act. I mean, there's a lot of crossover, and this is a way that we feel like we are supporting our members and our provider partners, because every day they see the, you know, the untold amount of human suffering that accompanies you when you are uninsured and you need health care, like we just heard from the previous panel, and not to mention cost shift when there's uninsurance and the cost that it adds to our system. And so HJR 18, I think, is a nice building block for the work you're trying to accomplish here in the state, and CARE Oregon supports it. So I'll leave it at that. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them now.
It is interesting you raised Wyden's proposal, which is Wyden and
Bennett, I think. Bob Bennett, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very bipartisan proposal, mm-hmm. which is about half Republicans and half Democrats, something like that. And it begins with the assumption that every American needs to have access to health.
That's correct. And most, if I may add, Chair Greenlick, most of the proposals at the federal level also make that assumption. What they're trying to do with major health care reform assumes that everybody's in.
Not counting the president's.
Well, maybe counting the president's proposal.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Livingston?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Kat Livingston. I'm a family physician, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Public Health Association, who very strongly supports House Joint Resolution 18, providing everyone access to effective, medically appropriate, and affordable health care. The Oregon Public Health Association thinks that universal health care is essential. It'll improve equity, improve access to essential preventive services, cut health care costs, and prevent unnecessary disease and death. And it's interesting because as part of my testimony, I'd said this country is based on a premise of the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I think if we just looked at the number of people who have testified, I think over half of people have commented on this life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But that's why I went into medicine, because I believe I've dedicated my entire career to medicine and public health, believing that that's the most effective way to ensure that every individual has the ability to achieve their own potential. And here you all have the opportunity to pass a bill that will really help every individual in Oregon achieve their full potential. And that's a really amazing thing. As a physician, I frequently see the health impacts of people who are underinsured or uninsured. I think of one particular striking example, this wonderful 62-year-old patient of mine who has heart disease and a number of other comorbidities. And she would drive 40 miles to see me because we had such a strong relationship, but she couldn't afford to see me. She couldn't afford to come in and see me very often. And she would only take her blood pressure medicines intermittently because she couldn't afford them. She had a stroke. And that was totally preventable if she'd been able to take her medicines and see me regularly. And that's just sad. That's really sad. That shouldn't happen in our country. So one-third of uninsured adults have chronic illnesses, and they don't receive the care they need. And the people who receive the least amount of preventive services are the ones who need it the most. There's really good data to support that regular access to primary care results in lower costs, better health outcomes, better quality, and prevents disease. And these aren't just numbers. These aren't just arguments. These are people's lives, and it's important. So while cost should not be the only reason that this resolution should pass, it's a compelling argument. Despite spending more money than any other country, we're still ranked 37th in the world for health system performance and 72nd for overall level of health. Inequity and poor health outcomes are the key reasons for this. So access to effective, medically appropriate, and affordable health care is a right. It will improve the health and well-being of all Oregonians, and I really thank you all for taking this opportunity to improve the public health of Oregon and enable everyone to achieve a higher level of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question? Thank you both. We will close the public hearing on HJR 18. I will ask you, as soon as we get the material, to forward this on with a due pass recommendation to the Rules Committee. As I said earlier, the Rules Committee is having a referral fair pretty soon, or something like that, looking at all the proposed referrals to try and get some balance in what we send to the ballot and the general election of 2010. Yes, thank you very much. I do want to move forward both HJR 18 and HJR 20, HJM 20, HJR 18, with the hope that we get fiscals to move them tomorrow. If we don't, and with the reminder of my good administrator, we'll roll them forward again to Friday. I want to open a work session on House Bill 2009 and ask Tom, will you join us, please, to talk about the amendment situation. There has been a decision from above, and the tax is going to be taken out, the tax and expansion piece is going to be taken out of 2009 and moved into 2116. I did take cognizance of the comment that you made in one of your amendments. I looked at 2116 and it has the same language. I think that's where we got the language on how you calculate the base rate.
I had a conversation with Dr. Goldberg, and we decided we will have an amendment that moves it back to the current definition of how that's done, so it doesn't get into that question of charity and
so if it's moved back into 2116, the language in 2116 already is the old language.
No, it's not. It turns out it's the new language. That's where we got it from. So we need to change it back.
Oh,
we will have some amendments. We'll have a bunch of amendments, and one of the amendments will move it back to the current language, which is you take out the addition and you.
That's the old language.
Well, yeah, and it isn't the cost of those. It's the. It's the charges of those because it's all a charge. Okay. So the hope is that we will have 2116 ready by Friday. We've posted it for a work session on Friday. That will have the amendments that move the sections that, well, we'll have separate amendments that will delete those sections from 2009, and we'll add the expansions, including the expansions that we had amendments for, into 2016, and we should have a full package, and we hope, in 2016 by Friday, and we will try and work it and move it. We've had a public hearing on it before. Any questions about that piece?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, you may have mentioned this, and I apologize for asking. 2016 will have a subsequent
2116.
2 1 2. Okay, 2116 will have a subsequent referral to revenue
and Ways and Means.
And Ways and Means.
Yeah, my hope is that it will go to revenue and Ways and Means. 2009 will go to Ways and Means, and they'll catch up with each other, and we'll have it on the floor, sort of in tandem, or at least nearby each other. Yeah. So.
Thank you. You said that. I'm sure. I just.
I didn't. It has. In amending 2009, we'll take out the language of requiring 3/5 vote and all that stuff that's at the end of the relating to clause.
Mr. Chair, yeah, but the bill's going to go from 594 pages down to 591 pages.
Yeah,
it's a lot simpler.
Okay. It will. But in concept, it's a hell of a lot simpler. And it only will require 31 votes, which I hope will be several Republicans will join us in voting for it now that the tax is out of it. Although I hope several of you will vote for health care for kids and others by voting for the tax as well. Tom, do you want to review where we are? We'll be out of here pretty soon.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Tom Burns, health policy consultant to the chair. You have, I hope, a package of seven or eight amendments, starting with the dash 44s and proceeding through the dash 50s. Uh-oh. Time out.
Not yet.
Just what are these?
What are these? What do we have in front of us?
Oh.
Are you going to talk about those two?
We have some.
I have no idea what these are.
Are they?
We've got the big
first, maybe the first 24 pages.
Just the
they are the first, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is old stuff, right?
Yeah. Wait.
This one is old stuff.
Not yet.
That technical
okay.
problem. But it is old stuff.
It is.
This is the reference we're going to be working from, which is the.
Mr. Chair,
if we tax the people in the line waiting for the amendment, we'd be halfway there.
There aren't any amendments. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Tax to pay for health bill 2009.
Nothing worth talking about.
Could at least pay the printing costs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, what's the fiscal already?
No. I think there's a proposal for the next rules, for the next session, that no bills can be over 42 pages.
No, the proposal is you only have 100 pages of bills total, and you can work within that as you desire.
Right. You do what you will.
Yeah. All right, Tom. Please tell us where we are. We're not planning on working anything tonight, is
okay.
that right?
That would be my recommendation to you, but I will at least go over these so you know what you have in front of you.
And then we'll work them quickly.
Yeah. It's also important, Mr. Chair, for you to recognize that you do have two different documents that are starting points in front of you. One is the Dash 10 amendments, which you have adopted and have been incorporated into the A engrossed version of 2009. Now, for reasons that I do not understand, it will not attempt to understand, LC has said that for amendment purposes, you can amend either of these two documents. And the amendments you have in front of you actually, some of them amend one document and some of them amend the other document. I will walk you through it.
It was because they were writing amendments before they had the A and Rose form, and they didn't want to wait for them. And they said it'd be no problem for them to straighten it out when we vote on it. So some of the amendments will be linking to this and some linking to that. And I do want to point out that 24 pages is the whole substance of this before we take out some of the sections.
Okay.
It's turning into a very simple bill.
So, Mr. Chair, starting with the Dash 44 amendments, which are done to the Dash 10 amendments. So the page and line reference in front of you are to the Dash 10 amendments. They simply add to the duties of the board a requirement that the board work with commercial insurers and DCBS to create a single product to be offered within the small group market that will contain costs through common underwriting standards. This is language that has been brought to us by the insurance industry as a means to try and help provide better products in the small business market. Now, this language also is subject to being rewritten, but the policy concept is still the same.
I do want to comment. I had a bill that would have done this in the last session that ended up with a fight between two heavyweight Republican lobbyists, and one lost.
Mr. Chair.
Very odd situation. Me sponsoring a bill. Yes.
Thank you. Is it possible? I realize the amendments are done on the Dash 10s and some are done on the A and Gross. Can you tell us where in the A and Gross all the Dash 10s are?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you want to work against the A and Gross?
I would prefer to work against the A and Gross.
I can crosswalk you to that.
Right,
it is generally being added.
What section?
We will not work all of these, but we should note all of them so we know.
Yeah, I just wanted to make note in the A and Gross where these are so we can go back and look at them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, it would generally be added as the first line on page 9 of the A and Gross bill. It is a J continuing the duty, the authority shell duties. If you look on page 8, Section 10, the authority is established, the duty, the authority shall. Under that list, you have A through I ending at the bottom of 8. On the top of page 9 or the bottom of page 8, wherever you are more comfortable, you would insert a J.
Between line 44 and line 45.
Between 44 and 45.
I'm sorry. Yes, between line 44 and 45. My apologies. Yes.
Thank you, Charles.
Am I looking at, I, there it is. Okay, I is on page 40. This no, comes after I, right?
Yes.
Right
here. So it'd be right between here. Lines 44 and 45.
Okay.
Dash 44, line 44.
Okay, go on.
Okay, the next one, which is the Dash 45, is an amendment that was brought to you as a means to strengthen the cost containment mechanisms contained in the bill. Under section 9 on page, I can't read it, 7, line 24, G currently reads, establish cost containment.
I'm sorry, I lost you. Give me it again, please.
Page 7.
Of the bill.
Of the bill, line 24.
This is a new G,
This is a new G, although it would be my recommendation to you that you not adopt these and wait for some cleanup to this, but the concept is the same. It is a means to try and strengthen the cost control mechanisms by starting down the path of reimbursement rates, using reimbursement rates to incentivize comprehensive management of diseases, quality outcomes, and the effective use of promoting cost-effective procedures, services, and programs, including, without limitation, preventative care, dental primary care, web-based offices, telephone conversation, and telemedicine. And again, these are various words and proposals that have been out there in the Ethernet and in the discussions, and were brought together in sort of one package to strengthen the cost containments. The second portion of the amendment takes the same words and gives that duty to the authority. And the reason why it's in two places is one is to direct how the board does policy, and the other is to direct the authority as it starts to do reimbursement rate reform, how they might consider doing reimbursement rate reform. And again, it would go on page 8, between lines 44 and 45. As you can see, we now have two J's, J from dash 44 and the J from dash 45.
We have been told by LC that within some reason they can handle multiple amendments that seem to go in the wrong place and that they'll fix them up. But we may do it that way or we may not. It depends where the LC comes out as to whether we want to put some of these together.
The dash 46s.
Does that takes care of the other J as well, right?
That takes care of the other J as well. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
The dash 46s would go on page 7. Would go on page 8 between lines 2 and 3. It is simply N of a long list of duties of the board, and the board is charged with working with the Health Resources Commission to develop a uniform surgical checklist. Different studies across the nations have recognized that if you use a uniform surgical checklist in the operating room, you reduce complications by 36 to 40% by having a uniform checklist, just like pilots do, that says whatever the HRC comes up with, that we think you will reduce the cost of errors that occur in the surgery.
Dr. Representative Kotick, can I ask a question?
Yes, Mr.
I think this is... This came from your fertile brain?
It came from reading the newspaper.
Okay.
and I
My
really
question is a simple one. Is it the Health Resources Commission that usually does this sort of thing? The
Patient Safety Commission?
The Patient Safety Commission, I think, is working on it for a volunteer.
Okay. I have no problem with the amendment. I'm just not sure that we need to get, like, that's pretty far down into the weeds on... I have a problem with checklists. As a pilot, I have a problem with checklists. But
it's one of those weedy items for 2009.
Very weedy.
Yeah, we don't want to stir the pot.
Well, we'll decide. But the question, whether we want this or not, and I had some of the same concern, is this...
Would you prefer to run it as a separate bill? And frankly, I think putting it out there 2011 and just... Though I am very appreciative of the fact that you want to include this, I think this is far too weak. I think the evidence shows that we should require the use of this checklist, and if for some reason that is somehow pushing the boundaries of good practice, I would like to have that, you know. I mean, I just think this is just, I would like it a little stronger than this. But
if we've had a bill that we can amend this into that we've already heard, I think let's have a stronger bill and find out whether we really want to do it. All right, and I guess I would prefer not to have it here because of this. So let's, if we can figure that out before 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Well, the reason I say that,
I think House Bill 2117's relating clause would work, and if we're going to move the kids piece into 2116,
we could use it. Yeah, and we've had a hearing. We had a hearing on 17.
No.
But it can wait till next week.
We discussed the
policy. We need to post.
Yeah, you can post on Friday for hearing it next week.
schedule a work session.
I think we need to have a hearing before.
No, according to Sandy, we need to be able to post things by Friday for either public hearing or possible
or
work session after
okay.
the 17th. They don't
great.
Have to be heard this week.
Okay,
right,
great.
Representative?
Yeah,
let's work. I thought it was. But you had to post for a work session.
You have to post for a work session, but you don't have. What she's saying is you don't have to have had a
no.
public hearing in advance, so we could yeah. you could post it for
don't?
A public hearing and work session.
Yep.
Is what.
Okay.
Okay, let's move on.
And we had this in for a while, so I apologize for the change of course, but in retrospect, I'm
no, I
maybe
I
it makes
think
sense
it's
to pull it out, and then we'll try
and
to figure that out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, as we originally talked about, we also had some language in to try and enforce this, and unfortunately, if you pull the expansion piece out of 2009, you can't really enforce it in 2009, because it's an expansion piece that you should use
so
for
needs
enforcement.
To be separate, then. Okay, well, let's work on that. I think this is a useful thing to work on. I'd prefer to have it somewhere else.
Any reason to have, you know, the OMA and others come up and talk about a bill again. You know, right, Courtney?
I can't imagine anybody having a problem with this, really. I mean, this is so, I mean, it really is established. Tom, let's go.
Yeah, the Dash 47 amendments are occurring on page 14, lines 32 through 36. This is the no restraint of trade language. This language is being modified to make it a little broader. As originally considered, it was...
Sorry, Tom.
I'm
behind.
23.
Tell me where it is.
Page 14, lines 32 through 36. It is section 23 of the engrossed bill.
This is the Maurer Amendment, right?
As originally drafted in the A engrossed version of the bill, the restraint of trade provisions applied only to work done in the insurance exchange. It became clear as we talked to people that in order to do the essential benefit package, there also needed to be some restraint of trade protections. So this language will expand that restraint of trade to also allow for the discussion around the essential benefit package. Essentially, you can't build an essential benefit package without talking price, and you can't talk price amongst competing entities.
Tom, this is under the direction of the authority and the department, is it?
Yes. You have
that would need dual?
Yes, because the department is Department of Consumer Services is actively involved in the work on the exchange, and so they asked that we put it in.
It needs under both of their directions, not either? That was my question. This says working under the direction. Oh, okay. It's under their direction, not under. Not at their direction.
Not at, under.
I,
their
I got it. I'm sorry.
You have to have government in the room at the table.
That's right.
And this would put one or both of them in the room at the table.
I thought this meant at their direction.
No.
I misread it. Okay. That's the safe harbor amendment. It's to make sure there's room for conspiracy. Yeah.
The Dash 48 amendments are the amendments to pull the assessment out of 2009. They begin by... removing the three-fifths requirement of the bill and makes other various changes through there and then deletes all of the sections 36 through 54.
Hold on. The three-fifths is on page four up at the top.
Yes, sir.
And it may change those sections and things, but
so,
it.
This will be adopted to delete all the tax
out of 2009. Yes, and then there will be, as the chair has commented, this same words will then go into 2116.
It takes that reimbursement section, the tax section, and all the expansion sections out of this, and
right.
leaves only the. The health authority piece. Have you checked these? You think they're right?
I have, yes.
Okay.
They are right to the dash 10s. I haven't looked closely at the at the A in growth, but they are correct to the dash 10s.
Mm.
turning now to dash 49, the language you have in front of you is now language to amend the engrossed bill. So the line and page reference in 49 refer to the engrossed bill at this point.
Page 593.
This is a proposal that has come from a group of payment reform individuals who have suggested that we need to provide more primary care doctors in the system.
Page 593?
Yes, it's adding new sections to
the
bill.
Big bill.
Why are they adding them after the conforming amendments?
You have to ask that question of Ledge Council. Here's my sense.
They don't have to retype all.
They don't have to read. They don't have to renumber.
Restructure
everything. They're adding new words, lots of new words, and they're putting it at the end of the bill.
That may be one more reason not to pass these.
Just out of curiosity, didn't we just pass a bill that takes this loan repayment out of the Student Assistance Commission and moves it to the Office of Rural Health? Okay, but it's not
that
would be fixed later.
No, that's specific to that program.
Which apparently, I mean, to
is
me,
not this. It's specific to the rural the program for rural docs and nurses,
loans.
Right? Where, and they wanted it over in the Office of Rural Health. This is for all. This isn't just rural.
Or primary care.
Yeah.
No, for a bunch of people.
Right, but wasn't this, Mr. Chair? Wasn't this supposed to be for primary care?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dembro, if you look on, I'm reading a different document. I know where it is in one document.
Page 2, line 4.
Page 2, line 4. Thank you.
Yeah.
And line 10.
A person is eligible for a loan under this section if the person is a resident of the state, enrolled, willing to make a commitment to primary care, medicine, or nursing in this state.
Anywhere.
I see.
Anywhere
okay.
In the state.
Yeah, line 22.
Line 22 is if you, right. It's renewable annually as long as you continue to make that that commitment.
Where does the money come for this?
That is silent on where the money comes from. I don't know how this program works. I assume they have funds in it. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I misspoke. That is establishing a loan fund.
Page 3.
This doesn't fund this thing.
It does not.
It doesn't create a
repository.
Yeah, so it consequently doesn't create a fiscal.
I think it's unanimous.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Well, Mr. Chair, this is potentially a place that federal or other grant money could go to and then flow out of.
But it also creates a
foundation.
The last page 4, subtract, creates a tax incentive too.
Ah, here we go. So it will have a fiscal or a revenue.
Now, if there's no
federal tax or income, the amount of the loan.
Yeah, exactly. Only if it's funded.
Federal taxable income, the amount of a loan from the primary government that is not required to be repaid.
So that part of it that's occurring.
So,
I think that language, Mr. Chair, is if you end up with a loan that you're not required to repay it, it now becomes taxable income. And this, I don't know how you can subtract federal income, but you could protect state income tax.
Well, actually, in order to deal with the state income, you have to subtract it
from the
federal income.
Oh, that's what it means. You're not actually subtracting it from the federal income.
No.
It's on your state form you're doing that.
Correct. So this would be a state tax break.
Yeah.
Yes.
From tax
expenditure.
It would mean the loan you don't repay
is not taxable.
Within Oregon.
Within Oregon, on state income.
It would still be federally taxable.
Right. it's still
okay.
It's still okay.
Yeah, that could be a problem. Okay, let's keep going.
And Mr. Chairman, the last one is the dash 50s. Again, this is page and line referenced to the engrossed version of the bill. And there are a number of technical changes in here, and I'll walk you through them one by one. The first one of deleting various references deleting various references that are purely mistakes that LC originally had. On page 7, line 35.
Is there some theme to this, or are these a miscellaneous set of
corrections? These are a miscellaneous set of corrections.
Good, okay.
On page 37, line 35. This
page
is
what?
7.
I'm sorry, page 7, line 35. This is the creation of the publicly owned health benefit plan. And as you originally had proposed, what you wanted to do was to have the board create a business plan for the publicly owned health benefit plan and then report that plan to the legislature. This adds the words business plan.
And Mr. Chair, I think that's the language in the Oregon Health Fund Board report.
Yeah,
business plan for a
business. Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really.
Further down on the same page, page 7, line, I'm sorry.
Next page.
Page 8, lines 40 through 44 is what we're discussing here. This is an ongoing problem of trying to resolve how much authority the health authority will have over the setting of rates versus how much authority DCBS will have over the setting of rates. What you have wanted to do was to have the authority develop standards and methodologies for reviewing administrative expenses of health insurers and approving health insurance premium rates. That develop standards. Those standards would then go to DCBS, and DCBS would adopt those standards in rule and use them as they then review health rates. The language here, starting on, starting on lines 5 through 9 will accomplish that.
May I read it?
You may.
Just to be clear. So in consultation with the director of DCBS, develop standards and methodologies for review of administrative expenses of health insurers, approval of rates, and enforcement of rating rules adopted by the DCBS, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. We think we have this where DCBS agrees. We're not sure we have it where the health insurers agree it does what it is we think it does, but we think this gets DCBS and the governor comfortable with this section.
Continuing, Mr. Chair, on line 11 of the amendments, it inserts the words around the all claims database to make sure we understand it's the all claims all payer database.
Page 9, line 1.
Correct. Line number 12 of the amendments on page 11, line 16, modifies how the board will look at the exchange. It says they shall include consideration of the following instead of all of the following. And again, this was at the request of DCBS that word be changed. Lines 13 through 17 of the amendment are correcting some language surrounding how we move the family assistance insurance, family health insurance assistance program. It turns out that they are not a function of DAS. They are a standalone agency, and the way the amendments were drafted, that assumed they were in DAS. And in case you were really wondering about the word that was struck on the line 16 of the amendment, Graham has nothing to do with medical marijuana or anything else. It simply has to do with the fact that the word program is split between two lines. And the word Graham there is a continuation of the word program. Then it continues and deletes all the rest of 11 through 45 of this page. And if you turn the pages, you will then see it all put back in, starting with line on page 14, insert, and it puts back in and corrects the problem we created when we tried to take something out of DAS that wasn't inside DAS.
Well, this was the Health Policy Commission.
It was many things that got screwed up, yeah. On page 2 of the amendments, line 15 through 19, as we started working with the final engrossed bill, DHS came to us and expressed some concerns about how we were pulling it apart and how to handle some of the need to address HR, IT, support, general support services. So section 19A was added in to address that and to allow the Department of Human Services and the Healthcare Authority to share back and forth duties and functions around administrative, IT, HR, and other types of functions.
And why is this June 1 and not July 1?
You're ahead of me. I haven't gotten that far.
I'm on line 20.
I know. I'm still back talking about 19A.
Section 19A.
Section 20. The basic principle here, after talking to Dr. Goldberg and others, is that we'll establish the authority, and then all budget will stay in DHS, and all formal activities will stay at DHS. They'll work the plan. They'll begin doing things under the board, but under DHS auspices, and then on July 1st of 2011, the authority will be instantly created between June 30th and 30 days after September, April, June 30th and July 1st, so that all the work will go on, but everything will officially have the dual authorities between the OHA and DHS. And this is an inflation, but I think that line 20 needs to be July 1st.
Mr. Chair, you were correct, but unfortunately, if you look in the original bill, it also had June 1st.
Yeah.
And LC just pulled the same language across. So that needs to be July 1st.
Representative Garrett.
In Section 19A, Tom, as written, is that meant to be an indefinite authority to delegate?
No, up until January 1st of 2011. It starts with a date.
Up to July 1st?
January 2nd, 2011.
Why is this second?
Line 15.
Line 15.
19A, line 15.
Yeah, I wonder why January.
It says, on or before January 2, 2012, the departments and the authority may delegate. It doesn't talk about time frame for the delegation. It implies that on or before that date, they can make a delegation that could go on indefinitely.
Oh, I see your point.
Yeah.
They could enter into an agreement today that goes for 10 years.
And I take it your purpose is that they can have a delegation of authority to expire on January 2012.
That's the intent. It is designed to get through this transition period. I turned around and looked at my expert who's
I'm not sure. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Come on, join us.
You could probably do this with two commas.
She went home.
Let's not go into comma debate again.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, I think the intent from DHS's concern is to make sure, since there's just a lot of things that might need to be changed, so we have adequate time to thoughtfully do it, and that eventually the entity would become its own thing and everything would be smoothly transitioned and you wouldn't need ongoing shared, although, you know, again, you could have shared administrative, you know, we could purchase IT services, HR services, back and forth. So we'll clarify whether it's long-term, long-winded. Or,
right,
but
yeah,
the intent really was it was needed at the beginning to make sure that it isn't, that it's a low-stress transition for all parties involved.
I'm not sure that's correct. I wonder. I mean, Bruce talked about how you might not have to move everything over. That would mean you'd be delegating some things on a permanent basis from the authority to the department.
Correct. You may want to still have eligibility still over in CAF,
exactly,
and they'd still do the work for the Medicaid program that would be in the authority. You may want to buy purchase services for more administrative things, so ongoing might be...
You would need this on an ongoing basis to do those things, I think. I think what it means, well, we should find out what it is the department wants, but...
We have my deputy's meeting with the DHS folks tomorrow at 9:30 to kind of sort through some of the finesse of it, because we just saw this language today.
Well, if we want them to have an open-ended ability to delegate and structure, then there's no point in having the reference to the date in there at all.
Oh.
Right.
I would agree. I think so. Let's find out.
We'll work through the details.
Let's get on this one very quickly.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am, did you? Sir?
No.
Is it?
Mr. Chair, if you then, Section 20 on page 2, Section 20A on page 3, Section 21 on page 4, Section 22 on page 4 are all addressing
all the
problem of FEOP not being part of DHS. It's rewriting what's already in here, recognizing that they're not part of DAS.
Mm-hmm.
on page 5, lines 11, again, adding to the end of the bill, is some language that addresses the need to contract for procurement of part-time. I think, Mr. Garrett, this might solve your problems. Technical other professional services is required to discharge the duties between the two.
That may be where it is.
On page...
As you deal with Ledge Council, if it turns out, and I think it's inevitable, they're going to have to renumber all those pages anyway. I would prefer all these things inside the body.
Yeah.
So we can say to somebody, just look at page 1 through 22.
I will make sure they hear that.
If they can possibly do that.
On page 5, starting with line 24 through the end of the amendment, are miscellaneous changes that were identified as problems when we didn't completely pull out the desire to separate, to break up DCBS. As you recall, the original version of 2009 pulled all the insurance regulations out of DCBS. When we decided not to do that, some of it didn't get cleaned up right. And so the language there from 24 to the end are all putting little things back in. For example, in one case, the FEOP board, for example, they took the director of DCBS off and added the authority when they should have left the director and added the authority, thereby increasing the size of the board. And it was funny little things like that. And that, Mr. Chairman, is that set of amendments. Now, I will be happy to share with you what I have submitted to LC.
Please. Question first, just a quick technical question. These amendments that were not drafted to the ANGROS, the page and line references are not against the small print amendments.
Mm-mm.
They're from the other version.
This is the only version I have. I don't know what the small print is.
We have the House amendments to HB 2009, which I think are the same, but they're printed by the print shop when we get a bill in gross.
Okay.
And that's what was on the dais. So I was trying to follow in there, and it didn't line up at all.
We will make sure you have this document when we actually work it, which is the amendments that were in front of you when you adopted them.
And that's dash 10?
That's the dash 10, okay. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, Mr. Chair, in addition to the amendments that are in front of you, we're also awaiting amendments back from LC that would move five Senate bills into this bill, 451 Pulst, 452 IT, 455, I forget what that does, and 457 Workforce. What did it, what's 455?
Five-payer
database.
So comparative effectiveness.
Oh.
So those all have passed the Senate Health Committee and are currently in Ways and Means.
There are four, not five, right?
Four of them, yes.
Yeah, you said five.
Sorry. in addition, no, into this bill. I got to skip that one. 456 is the All Claims, All Payer Data. No, I'm sorry. 456 is the Integrated Health Home or SAM or Burns or Powers or Greenlick. We will have
I was going to pick one, right?
We have a long list of names for you to pick from, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, we're not going to just flip a coin.
We're working to give you a long list of names.
Yeah, you know what the names are that are up this open?
Yeah.
And then, no, you can't. Somebody else can.
Sorry.
We have what's the comment here? Wait a minute. Let me frame this. The issue is there have been two parties working on the primary care, whatever it's called, thing.
Integrated health home.
And they've agreed to the substance of it, but not the name. I propose that I have a blind sheet that gives me the names. And that I would pick one. I think that idea is okay to both parties. But if somebody else that doesn't know what the names are, what the game is, would like to pick one, I think that would be fine.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's been some discussion that we might want to give you more than the two choices.
For example, there is
the treatment-only medical program, TOM. There is the preventive options without emergency room screening. The Powers Amendment. There is a medical assistance underwritten by response effective health care. The Maurer Amendment. Managed Integrated Team Coordinated Care Homes. The Mitch Amendment. There is a Timely Integrated Necessary Assessment. The Tina Amendment. There is a Just, Efficient, Affordable. I can go on and on and on. We've had fun while waiting for you to come. And we will. I even have one for Mr. Garrett. Which, if I could find it, I'd read it to you. But we are working for all of you to have a stake in this.
Yeah, I mean, it really literally has come down to the point where they've agreed on everything in the substance and they're having trouble with the name.
Well, how about rock, paper, scissors?
No.
Two out of three?
I mean, if it really is just that, then I think we need to pick a name and move on with it.
Let's pick a name.
Make it the simplest.
Come on, boy.
What are we trying to name?
Sir, you make a decision. This is
what are the two?
Integrated health home and patient-centered primary care
home. Patient-centered primary care home and the integrated health home are the two that the two parties are working on. I actually prefer the TOM, but I have a bias to my...
Here's the issue. There is an issue related to the name. It's not just a name. The issue is that one sort of view of what the model is that this primary care home, whatever it is involved in the community in a broad way and would be held responsible for being involved with things like school health clinics and public health and other kinds of things. The other model is a model for places that say, look, we have a lot of small primary care practices that work very well and are willing to be held responsible for things inside their control, what happens in their walls for their patients, that they're willing to create a patient-oriented one, but that in their circumstances they can't really take responsibility for moving out into the community except where they can. But they're willing to be held responsible for outcomes that they do inside their walls for people they view as their patients. They've apparently worked out a compromise, is that right? So both... Is anybody here that knows anything about it? I heard earlier today.
Integrated.
Dr. Smith, will you?
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, Janine Smith, Administrator of the Office of Health Policy. The bill is going to be heard in the Jonathan Anderson committee, and there is the two names. There's been a lot of discussion. There's been a lot of work group. The Health Fund Board had suggested integrated health home for the more encompassing version. But the essence of the bill really is to set up an advisory committee that really sets the parameters and standards. So it's not, the name isn't necessarily setting anything in stone. It's just setting the standards. I'm not sure if there was a new agreement today. All I understand, there's two amendments, and we were going to let the committee decide what the ultimate name was going to be in the Senate side.
The amendments were just for the name of it, huh?
The difference between the dash threes and the what I presume is the dash and the dash fours is just what we call the actual program, the name of the advisory committee.
Are they coming out with this tomorrow? Is that what?
On Thursday.
Late.
And, Mr. Chair, I actually have asked for both amendments to be in front of you.
Ah, okay. So, yes?
Can we just, like, finish this and make the decision and move on?
Yeah, well, if we have time, I think the thing would be, if we're going to do it Friday, we would do the thing that comes out of the Senate. My assumption is on Thursday, one or the other are going to come out of the Senate.
I thought it was up to us to pick a name.
Well, not if they're actually going to do it.
Chair Greenlink, that's what I heard from Senator Mona Sanderson earlier today, is that they would
that's
decide on the name
Thursday
on Thursday
morning?
When they heard the bill on Thursday.
Okay, then we'll let them do it, and we'll...
I mean, no,
who knows?
Okay.
Sounds like it's a problem for the Senate to solve.
That's great. They can handle it.
They have more...
Leave the important stuff to them.
Minds.
Absolutely right.
Robust minds. Tom, what else have you got?
Okay, so in addition to the integrated health home or whatever you choose to call it, there are some amendments coming that will allow us to apply for some HRSA grants that give us a 5-to-1 return. The grant money can be used to offset the administrative cost of creating the authority. There is an amendment coming to insert the full version of the All Claims, All Payer database. There are two more amendments coming around primary care. Representative Kotek, I apologize off the top of my head. They're the 57 and 59, and I can't remember which does what.
Setting reimbursement rates for primary care at 150% of Medicare, and
right.
The other one is directing GME, graduate medical education dollars to primary care.
Right, right. Those are coming, and there is a workforce amendment that Representative Dembro has come up with. And that, as far as I know, are all the amendments that I am drafting on your behalf.
I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair, and I'm going to decide which of these we're going to bring forward for our discussion. If there's one that somebody else wants that I don't pick, then I will leave room to hear proposals on that. I suggest that I might take 11. I think I'm worried about the question of adding, since this is going to be a little more exposed without $1 billion in extra revenue that goes with it, I'm getting nervous about what the fiscals will look like when it gets to Ways and Means. I may be eliminating some that make me worry about increasing the fiscal. The fiscal gets a little more manageable when we're not dealing with some of the expansion issues that have significant fiscals. And there is going to be a group that will ultimately work as a part of the Ways and Means process to figure out what ultimately comes out is in or out of Ways and Means.
So, Mr. Chair, after we adopt whatever amendments are adopted, I would assume that we will wait for a fiscal before we pass it out of committee.
I am hoping that we will have an indeterminate fiscal before it gets out of committee. Since it's going to Ways and Means, it's not going anywhere else, and they're going to have to figure out what the fiscal is. So it is my hope that we have a fiscal light that simply says, looks like there might be some real money here. Send it to Ways and Means so we can figure it out. And that will give me enough information to know I prioritize it to want to send to them to work there. So I am hoping that, and I'm hoping the same thing is true of the revenue. Now, the thing I didn't say on 2116 is we will have two options once we get 2116 ready. We will have an option to send it to revenue with blanks in it, or we'll have an option to put numbers in it, depending on what comes out of discussions with the hospitals and the health plan. And that, again, will be a decision that's not our decision entirely. Our job is to get it ready and either have it ready to move with blanks or have it ready to move with numbers. But as you've heard in the newspapers and everywhere else, there are very serious discussions going on, both with the hospital community and with the insurance community. And we all know we're working under significant pressure in terms of...
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard that.
Really?
Yeah.
Come on. I read it in the AFL-CIO Weekly Press. In the last week. That's why. In fact, I even read, I think, what the range of discussion was that I was happy to hear. But no, there are... Well, I am happy to say that there are very serious discussions going on with the hospital community, and it's not secret because the representatives of the hospital community are checking in properly with people in the hospital community about it, and therefore, once you do that, it's automatically not secret. So it's long since not secret, but we'll see. Well, I really... Yes?
Mr. Chair, so the timeline of what's coming up, could you review that again?
Okay.
For 2009 and then 2116.
My hope is that we have 2009 and 2116 both ready to move on Friday. We have a lot of work to do in the week from then. We have a week and a Monday, and we have a lot of bills and a lot of things that we want to pass and some that we want to hear and decide. So if all goes well, I was hoping to have them all ready. I was hoping to have 2009 ready tomorrow. I suspect we won't. Is that right, Tom? You want to say? I mean, we obviously aren't going to be able to finish 2009 tomorrow. We clearly won't have everything.
I don't think we will have everything.
Yeah. So Friday is our ETA on.
Friday's the day to move out the bill?
Move out. I would hope move out both bills, but certainly to move 2009. Friday would be the day to move 2116 if we decide to move it to revenue with blank spaces on it. If not, we could hold it for another few days. I mean, if we don't think we're going to have numbers in another few days, then there's no point in doing it. But our schedule, the schedule that the leadership of the House and Senate are working on, is to have 2116 to the governor's desk by the 15th of May. That means through both houses, through revenue, ways and means, and both houses. That's doesn't leave much room. Michael, anything? Does that do it?
Yeah.
And then a bunch of bills. We have a pile of bills scheduled. We're going to be announcing tentative schedules for the rest of the weeks as we go along. By Friday, we'll have the whole thing posted for next week. There'll be lots of carryovers. There'll be lots of changes. There'll be lots of things taken off. So, and there'll be things on there that we really don't intend somebody to drive 500 miles to testify on if we're not going to really plan on working that bill. So before anybody gets worked up about anything on that list, check with us and find out how serious it is, whether maybe we're planning on working it so we can gut and stuff it with something else. I mean, there might be a variety of things, but life will get a little easier when we get through a week from two weeks from yesterday. I really appreciate you guys coming this evening. I think it really helped clear some things. I really wanted to go over these amendments so we can move them faster when they come. Tom Burns, as usual, continues to do an unbelievable job staffing this nightmare. I want to say that as many times as I can. Is that a mower?
No, that's it.
That's it. We're adjourned. I only have one more meeting tonight.